Welcome to my hearth.
We've been exploring the idea of Christmas in storytelling terms. And now we come to the main event of Christmas Day, the food. It's no surprise that food forms the basis of many elements of storytelling. There's a complete range of events that are food-based, everything from the lack of food in One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich to great feasts in Harry Potter. Even in our earliest Christmas stories and children's stories, we're obsessed with the idea of something special and something different. We like the idea of Winnie the Pooh's need for honey, Paddington's lust for marmalade sandwiches. One of my favourite stories when I was a little boy was The Wind in the Willows, and especially the bit where the little animals go up the river and have a picnic, and it's described in the most delicious terms. We salivate along with Mowgli when Rat describes to him all the different concoctions that he has prepared. Enid Blyton's Famous Five are always going on picnics with lashings of ginger beer and slabs of Aunt Mary's fruitcake. For Victorian writers, especially Charles Dickens, food became symbolic in the way that it was dealt with. Oliver Twist asking for more is one of the key moments in the story. That's why I've entitled this particular episode Food, Glorious Food, that being one of the first numbers in the musical based on Oliver Twist, Lionel Bart's Oliver. Where there were layers of society, from the very rich to the very poor, then you become very interested in what these different levels of society are eating. Ebenezer Scrooge, the miser in A Christmas Carol, starts off eating the food of the poor, and by the end of it, he's dishing out the feast of the rich. The food's symbolism has many layers of meaning in it. The fact that the Cratchit family makes every attempt it can to have the symbolism of a Christmas dinner, however meagre it is. Dickens' description of what a proper Christmas feast should be not only forms the basis of our understanding of Christmas, but he created the very idea itself in Victorian culture. His ideas have gone through many different incarnations as stories have progressed. But just mentioning one or two, the Australian nation has a wonderful Christmas story called The Magic Christmas Pudding, which becomes the kind of pudding you want it to be every time you eat it. I've already mentioned the feasts in Harry Potter, which obviously appear magically, but are there because they symbolise the fact of people sitting around together and enjoying eating together. Christmas dinner is not just the food, it's the point where everybody comes together and sits around a table. It is a sharing of that particular special moment. It is a kind of breaking of bread. It is literally a celebration. It has a religious feel about it. Many religions have a meal as part of their rituals. The gift of hospitality becomes a major thing in storytelling. I am always amazed that every time I'm going to do a podcast, something comes on the television that goes, oh, that fits in with my podcast. And yet again, it happened last night. I'm actually recording this on the 16th of December, although it will not be broadcast until January. But last night on the Graham Norton show, Gregory Porter, the jazz musician, the man who wears the hat, came on Graham Norton and was talking about Christmas and the fact that when he was little, although there was, I think, 7 or 8 children, I'm not quite certain if I've quoted that correctly, what his mum used to do was cook an immense amount of food and then they would go out and distribute it to the poor and the needy, whoever needed a meal, and then the children came back and feasted on what was left over. And by that, she was pointing out the true meaning of Christmas for her. Christmas for me, when I was little, was a very similar experience. I couldn't say, in any particular year, how many people sat down for Christmas dinner, but there was always someone who was not a member of our family. It was a tradition that was started by my maternal grandmother, that if there was someone who didn't have anywhere to go for Christmas Day, she would invite them to her house, even though they weren't particularly well off. She thought it was very important that people didn't have Christmas alone. My mother, who was generosity itself, continued with this tradition, and we always had one or two people who had been invited to Christmas. I realised as I got older that not only were they given the gift of a delicious dinner and all of my family were amazing cooks, but they were always given a present, both in the cracker that they pulled and also an appropriate gift given to them, so that they felt that they had been part of a family on the significant day. I'm sure many of you will recognise the fact that the day had to be planned like a military offensive. Timing was so important. I'm going to say when I was younger that there were probably 14 or 15 people for Christmas lunch. But however many there were, the bird of choice tended to be a turkey. My little grandma, who was the equivalent of a kind of surrogate district nurse in whichever village she was living in, was very good at doing the turkey, and by that I mean taking out its guts and dealing with the giblets and all of that. I didn't have anything to do with that, but used to watch with eyes half closed from a distance as the operation was enacted. It was prepared, dressed, smeared with butter and covered in bacon with 3 different kinds of stuffing, and got all ready the night before, and then it was put in the range early in the morning of Christmas Day. There was applesauce and cranberry sauce, all the things that people would want. My mum also liked to make a kind of sausage meat stuffing, which she actually made in a separate dish rather than put inside the bird, because she said it was a bit too juicy for that. There were little chipolata sausages. There was as many kind of roast vegetables as you would want. There were steamed vegetables. There was copious amounts of gravy. We seemed to make more gravy than anyone I knew. When my lovely granddad Tommy was alive, he did the carving and he was amazing at it. Not only could he make a knife razor sharp, but he would cut everything into such thin slices that it was a delight to look at as well as to eat. My father was a bit more cavalier with the carving and would have preferred to have taken a big pair of kitchen shears and just chopped everything up. My grandma always used to say that he massacred a bird when he cut it up. I think that was possibly because of his cooking in the army and having to do things very quickly. However, what he was brilliant at and continued to be his whole life was preparing vegetables. He could stand for hours getting things ready, and they were always beautifully done. Moreover, he was the most amazing washer-up. If you got a chance to wash up with him, it was always a delight, because he made it a kind of game, and he knew the exact order of how pots and pans should be washed up. In our own household, he always used to say that Mum did the cooking and he did the clearing up. Many stories are based around the fractious nature of what a Christmas dinner could be. Not surprisingly, the people that had got this huge feast ready were particularly exhausted, so it wouldn't take much for sparks to fly. However, because my little grandma and my mum were so used to creating huge meals all the time, they didn't tend to join in with this particular notion. There were other instances of mealtimes being very difficult, because my little grandma, for all of her size, had the temper of a large Tyrannosaurus Rex. I think the heady mixture of Irish, German, Geordie and Cumbrian descent were worked out in her in such a way that she was like an exploding Catherine wheel. My grandfather, however, was the exact opposite, and a nicer man you couldn't wish to meet. I didn't know him when he worked down the pit, but everyone who had worked with him always used to say that he was the most popular man in the pit, because there were things that he would do for people which were above and beyond what would normally be expected of someone. Again, he was generous to a fault, and also could make the best cup of tea in the world. Little Grandma was also generous to a fault, and had a slight habit, which could be very annoying, of giving things to people if she thought they wanted them. Living in one of the most beautiful places in the world meant that people always want to visit you. I've always said that we could have run a hotel with the amount of people that came to stay. I rarely was in Keswick on my own, as it were. There was always somebody coming to see us there. And when we were in Essex, my mum made it a feature that she would befriend anyone in the village who didn't have a friend. Like Grandma, this included making things for them. She was an amazing knitter, baking for them, cooking meals for them, and even at times doing their mending and laundry. My family was the local equivalent of a kind of social service. Now, when that came to be around the Christmas time, that obviously really happened to the nth degree. I know, especially when I was little and my dad was alive, we were relatively well off, but he certainly gave lots of his money away. Now I'll continue with the food theme in storytelling next time.